Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Boy, am I excited today. This is a really landmark day for me. My guest is Mark Danielewski. Now, Mr. Danielewski has traveled to get here today at this moment from Bali. He's been on the plane for 40 hours just to be here on Bookworm, and I'm really thrilled. He has written the first 5 volumes of what is said to be a 27-volume work. I don't think even in the days of serial novels we had 27 volumes. I have read the first 5. We're up to what is being called the series finale. And I have to tell you, I had my doubts, but now I am reading up a storm. I can't read this fast enough. I find it so enjoyable, so exciting, so funny, often challenging, great, great reading. I want to begin by asking you, are you pleased with it?
Yes. Pleased sort of implies a sense of satisfaction. And I think the thing that is so just overwhelming about this project is how relentlessly alive it is, you experienced it yourself, of how it is coming to life. You have that experience of starting where it feels like seemingly nothing, a rainy day, and then it begins to gather steam, very much the way a reader experiences it, gathering steam. And so that's the way I feel. I mean, I was just in Bali, but I was also in Singapore for work on this project, and seeing that part of the globe come to life as it will, you know, inform season 2.
Am I right in thinking that in this book, time and space become capable of overlapping? So a cat that I seem to have met in Singapore is rescued in America. It's a witch's cat, and therefore I assume it can make its appearance wherever it wants to.
There's a great deal of connectivity that is centered around this tiny, fragile creature.
Yes, I think one of the principles of this book is connectivity. Mm-hmm. What we have are many, many stories, and what we have is a world that is full of stories, like our world, and if we blink twice, we'll see where they connect. And that's what the book is doing over its many volumes. Sometimes we go back over turf we've already covered in order to see where other characters were, what they were doing, how they were contributing to the whole story. It's very exciting. What I can say as the bookworm is that it definitely has a plan, and as you begin to intuit its shape, it knocks you out. Now, did you know when you started by saying 27 volumes, would you do me the favor of telling me why 27?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to realize that I started writing The Familiar in 2006. So it was 9 years before Volume 1 came out. So how it was ultimately shaped, and this idea that it would sort of loosely be be held together by a television series began to help kind of delineate its whole shape. But the numerics are less important. I think the key is that what I realized was that I wanted to have a conversation with time. I wanted to provide an experience for the readers that was about experience something that wasn't a tweet, it wasn't a comment, it wasn't a blog, but it was the kind of conversation that had to extend a decade or two decades. Because how can we begin to have a serious conversation about climate change, about our lives, which if we're fortunate enough to could span a century? Where in our life, in our diet of culture, is there this experience of what it feels like to talk to something that takes a long time to develop and a long time to succeed?
The way I put it as I was reading was that while all books are about duration, the time it takes to read them, the time it takes for the events in the book to transpire, that these books are you're calling it a conversation with duration. I'm saying it's an experience of duration. First, we see a little girl wondering how you know how many raindrops there are. Before long, she is giving us her experience. We're looking at the letters and the words on the page as raindrops. They become a rainstorm. The rainstorm becomes a flood. We witness a flood as a typographical device, as an iconic device. And within that flood, well, what is the natural thing? As soon as you say flood, you say rescue. And so we're going to have to rescue something from the flood. And to some extent, the reader has to be rescued from the flood too. So we are immersed. This is immersive narrative of a sort I haven't encountered before. Can you talk about the ways in which you take the reader and dunk him in this book?
Well, it's the time we're living in, isn't it? It's literal floods and also the flood of information. And the question that we constantly have to ask ourselves is, how do we hear that which needs to be rescued? And that's what's so amazing and inspiring, and why I love all these characters, but Xanther in particular, is that she alone can hear through this flood, through this din, through this world over storm, the voice that matters the most. And it's the voice that matters the most because, Michael, it has no voice. And that's where I think literature has finally got to move. We're very good at giving people a voice, but we have not begun strenuously enough to give voice to that which will never have voice. The voice of the waves, the animals, the plants, this world that we inhabit that is part of our conversation, a part of our language. And yet literature is constantly denying that place. It constantly, even when it begins to discuss animals, too frequently it gives animals a human voice.
I'm talking to Mark Z. Danielewski, and we're talking about a book that has excited me top to bottom. I don't want to be unfair and say that I like this better than the other Danielewski books, but I do want to tell you that if for some reason you got off the train somewhere, it's time to get back on. This is a real ride. It's very, very exciting. Now, what struck me, we're entering the mind of the book, too. It's that this book has a voice of its own. It may be comprised from section to section of many different voices, but the book itself has a mind, and we're entering the mind of the book, not the mind of its author, not the mind of its characters, but a kind of invention of a book that has a mind of its own. Can you help me here?
Well, I also think it's about the heart of the book in a way. Because you were talking earlier about, you know, about seeing these connections take place, and that's very accurate. But I think what the novel enacts is the feeling of those connections, about how we begin to feel that these people might meet or might not meet. Because how often is it easy to look at a map and say you can go to point B to point Z? But how often do we miss those moments that matter because we were a little blind to the feeling that something was about to happen? We just simply aren't made aware of it. It's made too easy for us. And in these books, it's still easy, but it feels that way. It grants you the awareness without understanding why that things are about to come together and there will be revelation.
At the center of the book is a little girl. Her name is Xanther. And one of the things that the book is very good at is making us care about her. She has epilepsy. And it's kind of amazing because all of these characters, from the moment we meet them, exist in states of jeopardy. The father is a gamester who's expecting a check. The check has to come because the check is for a dog, an Akita, that will be trained to protect an epileptic child during an attack. But it's the mother, really, who wants the dog. And the mother is vulnerable, too. She's turned in her dissertation, which may free her to become a practicing therapist, but she's afraid to open the envelope, and we become afraid for her. And in particular, we're always, while delighted by her, concerned for Xanther. And it's not until Xanther finds something to save in her flawed. She doesn't need saving. She needs to save something. She needs to have something dear that is hers. Whereas she has been the dear property of parents. One of her fathers is dead. The other is a stepfather. They're all good people. But they don't seem to understand we all need our treasured and beloved thing. We're all vulnerable until we find the thing we love.
Yeah, that's beautifully put, because she, in that moment when she saves this tiny creature on the verge of extinction, that creature that is absolutely weak, that is perishable, does she begin to activate in herself a new kind of identity, a new process of realizing herself? And of course, the curious thing is, as you know, because you've moved further along in the volumes, is that it is this tiny creature which is so powerless that is at the same time so connected to that which is so powerful. And that is what she has begun to let into her life and the lives of others around her.
What I saw was that her senses are coming alive at that moment when she's stroking this poor thing that is barely breathing. Her father is going to give it artificial respiration, and then so is she. We are going to experience the tiny life force that it takes to inhabit and bring an imaginative construct, a narrative construct, to life. That's what the book is about, bringing to life all of its constructs. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Mark Danielewski about his books, The Familiar, Volumes 1 to 5, will continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Mark Danielewski about a life project, a serial novel called The Familiar. The most recent volume is Volume 5, which is called Redwood. But we travel, you know, through water, through forests, through continents, through space. This is, you know, this book wants to find a way to be the way our lives are, about vastness. And if we spend our lives ignoring the vastness around us, then we're limited. What these books, I think, are about is a reminder that literature is and was once about the vastness of experience that had not yet been considered, had not yet been captured in words. And this is an attempt to bring into words so many things, the way climate in its cycles affect the characters in the book and their lives. Now tell me, we were talking before about narrative constructs, narcons. What are they?
Well, Volume 1 has an abrupt pause where we are introduced to a narcon who begins to lay out how all of these characters and this plot, in essence, are narrative constructs. And at first, that may seem not only meta, not only computational, but also perhaps in its extreme kind of absurd. However, anyone who's interrogated themselves, who's become more and more aware of how a mind can awaken within you and then a new mind can awaken later on in life, is aware that our entire sense of self and the sense of selves of others are narrative constructs. We handpick the memories that constitute our self-image. So if we were to give those narratives voice, what would they be?
Okay, so out of the uncountable number of memories, experiences, but also mismemories and lapsed experiences, we are constructing ourselves at every second. I found the book to be enormous fun. I found myself reading the first of the volumes kind of slowly because I had to get used to who the characters were. This is a book you surrender to. That's the first act. You surrender and let it have fun with you. Then you'll have fun with it. But first, it's gotta be able to paw you around.
Well, one of the things that makes me extremely proud of The Familiar, you asked if I was pleased, is that I believe it grants the reader an experience that they can't get anywhere else. You know, there is this experience, literally because it's unfinished as of now, of its fragility. You're part of something that is like Xanthar's tiny little kitten, fragile. You are participating in watching that fragility strengthen, awaken, become part of a much larger system of thoughts, experiences, and emotions. And, you know, when people started with Volume 1, they're like, oh, I don't know how long this is going to take me. And as you and I were discussing earlier, by the time you get to 3 and 4, you're reading them very, very quickly.
Sort of the speed of light is not too much to say.
Well, what I say is roughly it takes about 12 hours to read each volume. So they come out roughly every 6 months. So all I'm saying is, you know, I'm not asking 2 hours a day or 2 hours a week, but 2 hours a month to have an experience that you can't get anywhere else, where you immerse yourselves in these different voices, these different characters that are connected to these primal conversations that are overwhelming us now. And I have to say, it is with great satisfaction that I am able to encounter the readers of these series, because they are so smart, they are so involved, they are so passionate. And what they are finding as they're discussing these books is kind of awakening to each other, an ability to have a discussion, a dialogue, as opposed to a rant, as an opinion. And I find that they do me the greatest honor simply in the tone of their conversation that this novel seems to elicit.
Nowadays, when I hear that a book is supposed to be difficult, I don't want a book to be difficult. I want a book to change my life. That's another matter. That's not easy to have happen, but it doesn't necessarily require difficulty. And I want from this book that changes my life, I want it to change my life the way Infinite Jest changed my life, the way, for me, The Sotweed Factor changed my life, the way The Brothers Karamazov changed my life, the way Gogol's Diary of a Madman changed my life. And every time my life changed, like the ticking of a clock. And that's what I want from reading. I want reading to show me how much I can change and change and change again. And most of the time when a book purports to that, I begin with my fists doubled and ready to resent the book. So I was ready to resent this book. I had every doubt about it, and it took me not just by surprise, but by storm. I was reading it with genuine enthusiasm. Now, having read 5 volumes of it, I can't wait for the next volume. But I am right at a ledge, a precipice. There's nothing ahead of me until volume 6 comes along.
I was working on it on the plane. I was working on it in Singapore. It's constant, so it will be done.
Now, how do you know that you can do it?
I am entirely reliant on my readers. And it's the readers that really, at this point, fill my sails. There is a congress in that. We are on a journey together. And it's, as much as this is my own, that building relationship, you know, even with you now that you've read the 5, sort of not only commands of me to continue doing it, but also energizes me as well. And it's terrifying, it's exhausting, it's constantly beyond my control. And yet at the same time, there is a life to it. And I expect that you experience that you begin to realize, like, oh, there's more here than me. And that's how I feel as the author, which is probably a strange thing for you to hear from an author.
This book seems to have, and I say seems to have because I may not know until, 20 volumes from now, but this book seems to have objects that are called orbs that change reality, and also people who are superintendents of that reality change, who can cause the life that they are in to alter into another reality, which will also have its ordinariness rubbing next to its extraordinariness.
It's not helpful to a reader to say, you will find angels walking among us. because people will then go out and look for those angels and they're not going to see them because they won't have had that visceral experience. And that's what the novel wants to give, is expose you to the ordinary and then allow you to understand how the extraordinary is suddenly within it. Because one of the attitudes that we constantly have, especially in literature, in politics, in our engagement with nature, is a siege mentality. We're a little, we're in our hall, in our fort, in our castle, and the world that matters or that threatens is from the outside. But really the way it works is that the extraordinary materializes within immediately. It's the porosity of those walls give way, and suddenly we realize that in every moment, in this moment right now, between you and me, Michael, there is something extraordinary awakening.
Well, there's everything awakening. Everything is there. And one of the things I learned from Mark Danielewski's very first book, House of Leaves, is that he is one of the most visceral novelists going. He gives you the feeling of experience. If it is cold, you're going to freeze. If it's dark, it's going to be thick and dark. There isn't going to be the ease that print gives you from the senses. The senses are very active here in the five volumes of The Familiar. Thank you, Mark, for coming all the way from Bali to tell me.
You're most welcome, Michael. To be continued.
To be continued. I've been talking with Mark Z. Danielewski, author of The Familiar. We've sort of alluded to volumes 1 to 5. It's published by Pantheon. Thank you for joining me. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Familiar at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. We're thinking about Mario all the time. He's had a family tragedy, and his place has been taken by J.C. Swadek today. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
She's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just reading this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.